Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel and Kim, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com, on today's US Open Finals catch-up.
King Carlos becomes the youngest ever ATP world number one.
Swiatek wins her third major.
And Krejcikova Siniaková complete the career Golden Slam.
Kim, today is the 12th of September and we are here to catch up on the US Open Finals at Tennis Weekly HQ. Carlos Alcaraz and Iga Świątek are your men's and women's singles champions in New York City. And we are going to be here discussing, as always, the finals action. We're going to be revealing collector set winner as well. And I just felt that this has been a real collective effort over the last couple of weeks. You know, Chris has dutifully filled in when we have needed him. And, you know, we started as a three and I felt that it was only apt that we end as a three as well.
Absolutely. Chris, we couldn't have done it without you. It's been a busy time for us all. So thank you so much for stepping in. And we're very glad to have you back today to cap off what's been a very interesting finals weekend at the US Open.
It really has been. I think it's one that's kind of split everyone in terms of who thought who would win and what history would be made, who'd become world number one, and can Iga win a Grand Slam on a hard court? It's been, everything has happened, and I think no one could have predicted this at the start. Well, maybe except Kim, who predicted Carlos to win it. But apart from Kim, no one else got it right.
Yeah, I have to say, on our preview pod, I did pick Alcaraz as the winner, but I changed my mind for collector set. So I should have stuck
I'll still
with
give it to you. That's good enough.
I'm not giving it to you. If you want to deviate, that's fine by you.
Well, you know, he must have listened to me in somehow because he's a Grand Slam champion. He's world number one. It's not often that you get two, you know, massive milestones in sport on the same day. I mean, it's just interesting how it's all turned up, how this final became all about, you know, a match for the world number one ranking, a match for a first Grand Slam title. It's just remarkable, really. And I mean, we all thought he'd get to be world number one at some point, but did we really think it would be so quick and he would do it at such a young age? I mean, Carlos Alcaraz is now the youngest ever world number one in ATP rankings history, since the open era. Also the fourth Spanish world number one, can I just say? Let's talk about the final, first of all. He won in four sets in his first, you know, Grand Slam final. But I guess remarkably what he'd done to get to that point, so much time spent on court, so many five-set matches, going into it, you know, I wasn't, you know, obviously present for your semi-final pod, but was thinking, is he a bit tired? I know he's 19, he's very fit, but it's a lot of time spent on court going into it. But I mean, how did you make of his performance to claim his first Grand Slam title?
Yeah, it was really impressive. Particularly, I think it all hindered, to me anyway, on that third set towards the end of it in the tiebreak. You know, Ruud had his chances. He had multiple set points and wasn't able to take them. And you did feel, you know, just watching it on TV, that if Ruud had taken one of those set points and gone two sets to one up, given the amount of tennis that was already in Alcaraz's legs at that point, to then go and win sets four and sets five felt like a very, very tall order. But I think it just shows the, you know, the never say die attitude of Alcaraz, that, you know, remember he was match point down against Jannik Sinner. And to come back from that point to get to the final and then, yeah, have these moments where, again, he was, for me, almost kind of flirting with what felt like virtual match points to Ruud, and to come through them and to play that tiebreak the way he did in the third set, coming through 7-1, for me, was the moment when I thought, oh, hang on here. This is Carlos Alcaraz's time. And for me, that tiebreak really kind of said it all in terms of his attitude, how he was embracing the moment. And I think, you know, he's coming into this not with a great tiebreak record, but he really felt like, I think he needed to raise his game in that moment to make sure that Casper Ruud's chance wasn't going to be fulfilled.
Yeah, I think the tiebreak for me, this is a slight differing of opinion here, because I feel like the tiebreak was such a letdown. I felt like that set was so tight and it had lots of kind of up and down moments. We were at one set all, and that tiebreak needed to be exceptional, and only one player brought their game. Casper hit, I think, four of the worst unforced errors he hit in the entire match. And in the interview afterwards, he said he still wasn't able to get over the fact he missed those two chances at 6-5 to break. And I was watching it back, and he said that Carlos played those points particularly aggressively. And actually, I think that Casper backed off. And I think that's the difference between someone who's out there to win it and someone who potentially would like to be gifted it, because he dropped a return of the 30-40 point so short, and then Alcaraz punished it. And I think it's that sort of youthful, never say die sort of mentality that kind of got him through. But the tiebreak for me was a big letdown in this one. But still, it's impressive to keep your head.
Do you think Ruud got stage fright in after he got those set points, when it was like a moment of realization? It's like, oh, hang on, I could become Grand Slam champion and you know, be world number one in the world. And it almost gave him, yeah, stage fright. And as a result, he got to the tiebreak, and it felt like maybe, you know, maybe he already realized that, oh, you know, my moment's come and gone here.
I think he did for the first time. He said he hadn't thought about the world number one really going through the tournament. And, you know, when you're up, he wasn't up the first set, obviously. And that was where the match felt like it was turning around. And yeah, it's hard to, you know, that's the first time you're like, oh goodness, it's on my racket. Or it could be. And that set did feel like it was. But again, it is so impressive, as you've said. It's almost like very fitting the way that Alcaraz came through, because it's how he played the tournament. You know, always coming back, never thinking he was out of the running. And every time he was down, he produced something special.
Yeah, I mean, he's got such a good five-set record. So even if Ruud had snapped, you know, got that third set, whether it was, you know, with those set points, or he had managed to get it in the tiebreak, were both of you thinking that Carlos would have come back and won in five anyway? Or do you think his legs would have got a bit too tired after all of those, that time on court coming into it? I think it's, you know, he's had the most time on court to get to the point of winning a Grand Slam, 23 hours and 39 minutes on court, more than any other player in history for winning their, you know, a Grand Slam. So I know he's only 19. He should have the freshest legs of all, really. But could you have seen him still winning in five? Or do you think it was that third set?
I just couldn't. I think it was all or nothing for me on that third set. And it was, you know, it was unbelievable. We don't, I feel like, associate doing these sorts of things, you know, at his age. And, you know, to see him do it, I think, throughout the 2 weeks, for me, arguably was more impressive than the match itself. You know, I think the journey coming through each of the matches, you know, going from five set match to five set match. And then even this match, even though it was as four sets, was still very physical at times. And although I think we've had more, dare I say, entertaining finals, I feel like at times maybe the crowd was a little bit subdued. I think when you look back on just what he has gone through, it really shows, I think, you know, that I feel like that barrier that in order to break through to win your first Grand Slam, I always feel like it's the toughest thing to do. And I will always kind of think, look back on his campaign here and, you know, just to show how tough it can be. I would look at how Alcaraz did it, because, you know, spending almost 24 hours on a tennis court against such high level opposition in such a big environment, when, you know, all the press and the media are, you know, fixated on you, particularly in the final rounds, when, you know, Rafael Nadal's gone out, Daniel Medvedev's gone out. They're all sort of, I think, kind of pointing to you. It's been incredible.
He really seized the moment. And I think that's something that we saw with Emma Raducanu last year. And when you haven't won that first Slam final, it does get increasingly harder, and it's in the back of your mind. I mean, that's a theme of this finals weekend. Obviously, Ons and Casper have both had two finals this year. And I don't think it made it that much easier for them to perform in this final. We asked the question, would it have helped having the more, having had that experience? And I think it actually makes it almost harder to get over the line. And going into sort of the third, if they do reach a third final, I think it will always be in the back of their mind, unless they do a Simona Halep, you know, and then three's a charm. But it's something that it doesn't get easier. And so I think for Casper, that moment where he thought about it, that could really be something that if he is in a winning position again, it's hard to not think about it in that moment.
Yeah, and I think for Casper Ruud, although he had that experience of being in a slam final earlier this year where, you know, he was facing Rafa on clay at Roland Garros.
His idol, yeah.
Exactly. Very, very difficult. But also this match against Alcaraz, you know, who, no offense to Casper Ruud, probably does everything just that little bit better than Ruud on a tennis court and is kind of the shining star and darling and of the tour and, of you know, this season he's been one of the standout players. So also a very different prospect to come up against. And, you know, he did very, very well, Casper. You know, he got that second set, he drew the match level, could easily have gone 2-1 up. So, yeah, it could have been a different story. And I, perhaps going into it, I was thinking that he had a bit more of a chance, whereas now I'm thinking in retrospect, oh yeah, this was always maybe meant to be Alcaraz. He wasn't going to let that one go. I mean, Alcaraz, just remarkable really, because we're not even probably seeing him at his best. Like, he's only 19. He's got a long way still to go and to develop. It's what his coach, Juan Carlos Ferrero, said, that he thinks he's only at about 60%.
That's of scary.
What he can be, which does that give any hope to anyone else if that is the
might
truth?
As well pack up now.
Yes, give up. What I think is also nice is that Alcaraz has said he will play the Davis Cup next week, despite having spent, you know, I don't know, 24 hours plus on a court to win his first Grand Slam title. Like, he's obviously dedicated to playing for his country as well, which is super, super nice. But yeah, I just think now he's got to where he's got to, world number one, first Grand Slam title. It's going to be now interesting to see how he acts and behaves now that he's achieved this feat and where he goes next.
Yeah, I think for me, what's interesting is that I certainly think, you know, the setup he has around him, the camp he has around him, this certainly does not feel like job done here. You know, we're going to be talking about Carlos Alcaraz in terms of, you know, how many Grand Slam titles is he going to win in his career. I guess my question, Kim, you picked up on it, the fact that Juan Carlos Ferrero, his coach, said he thinks he's only at 60% of his game, he can improve a lot of things. Where I mean, question to both of you, where do you think that 40% lies in terms of improving his game? Because I thought it was really interesting that I think Tim Hedman on commentary yesterday spoke about he didn't feel like Carlos Alcaraz had any weaknesses. He spoke about it more like there were just areas that were just not as strong as others. And I sort of see what he's saying in terms of I watch his game on court, and there are times when I just think, like, how do you beat this guy? Because he's just so competitive. He has, you know, really strong. He's really strong-willed, particularly in the big moments. He's an entertainer, and even the shots where I'm thinking, maybe there's a chance to improve, they're still pretty solid. I mean, for me, particularly the backhand, I thought, you know, the Alcaraz backhand and the Ruud backhand, I think there's quite a little bit of difference there, and I think that was for me one of the shots that certainly was in Alcaraz's favor, you know, from the back of the court when it was in a kind of a rally situation. But where do you think that other 40% lies?
It's got to be mental. I think he's got the physicality, he's obviously developed pretty young, he's got all the shots. I think it's the nature of being able to get it done quite quickly, and I think that's something where we've seen in this tournament he might win the first set and then he has a bit of a dip. And I think that's something where if you think about the nature of the game, he does end up in lots of long points and kind of ceiling points that he shouldn't necessarily be winning. But I think it's more about actually dictating the play. There are no weaknesses in his game. I think his serve could probably improve, and it will improve as he, you know, gets stronger, if that's possible. But I think there's definitely opportunities on the serve to improve, on the second serve to improve. But I mean, all players keep working their serve as they develop, and it's something that everyone has to keep working on. But I think it is the nature of putting people away, that bit sooner and trying to keep that concentration so that it doesn't take, you know, a tweener or some sort of incredible retrieval
miracle
skills.
Shot. Yeah.
Yeah, because it means that you're able to conserve some of the energy. I mean, clearly he's got enough energy. He doesn't need to conserve it. But I think it's about that becoming, as now he's the number one, becoming that dominant force and not kind of having to go to five sets against almost anyone. But that's obviously not too fair. He did win several matches in straight sets this tournament, but you know what I mean.
No, I get you. I think, avoiding the five sets would be better for
and the
him
match
going
points.
Forward. Yeah. learning how to convert break points against like Jannik Sinner, because I think that was his issue previously when they've played. It's just Sinner's been able to save so many break points. But, he's obviously got over that Sinner hurdle, but yeah, had to save a match point to get there. And I mean, what a way to come through and win your first Grand Slam title. Just a note on Casper Ruud, he is world number two. So he is, his ranking has significantly gone up. I was looking at the rankings earlier. It's all very close. There are kind of 20 points that separate some of the guys in the top 10. So it's subject to change. I think Alcaraz is about 1,000 points ahead at the top now.
I think though Casper Ruud he shot himself in the foot by going to world number two. He can't play ATP 250s on clay as world number two, can he?
Well,
oh yeah, why not? I think it's why not skip the Grand Slams and just add a European clay court swing in.
He could the Golden Swing next year if he wanted to.
I mean, just on Casper Ruud. I mean, where does this Grand Slam put him? You spoke about the parallels with him and Onsjibor, the fact that there have been multiple slam finalists this season, but both times have ended up as the runner up. Do you gain confidence from the performance he's put out here against Carlos Alcaraz that he could be a Grand Slam champion in the future? Or do you think, this doesn't bode well in the sense that we're seeing Alcaraz arguably peaking now, and maybe we thought actually there was a few more years for Ruud and other players to maybe get some titles before, the era of Carlos Alcaraz might be ushered in. Where do you think Casper Ruud is at the moment in terms of how close he is to being a Grand Slam champion?
Well, he's playing fantastic tennis, and he's played some of the best hardcore tennis we've ever seen him play. So I think when he was talking afterwards, he's obviously got to be pleased with his performance, because as we said, I mean, I had him to go out in the first round. He was a 65-1 outsider.
Yes, to Kyle Edmund. That was very ambitious.
You know what? I just thought back the Brits. I just thought Kyle's back. He's inspired. And Ben Shelton had just taken him out to 3-3. So 65-1 is the outsider. I think even kind of Casper wouldn't have seen himself in the finals. Seems to be what he said. So I don't think that there's any reason to be down on himself in this. He put in a better performance than the last Grand Slam final he had. So there's lots of things you can take from a confidence perspective. I think getting to the final in the future won't be like something I think obviously he could do that. He's demonstrated he can. But I think it's that winning mentality that it's a bit harder to close a Grand Slam than it is a 250 based on what we've seen so far.
I think he's got to hope that he just doesn't come up against someone who is either a Rafa or a Djokovic or an Alcaraz. I think if he'd like, for example, come up against, I don't know, Khachanov in the final rather than the semi, like I would have gone for Ruud to win that. So I think it is a sort of element of luck of the draw as well. But really, until then, he's got to develop that extra something that is going to mean he can compete in a Grand Slam final against the big guys. But I don't think it's... I can see him winning a slam.
French Open? You think he's... Do you still see him more as a clay court?
It's got to be Wimbledon. He loves the grass.
Well, you never know. We've seen some strange things, haven't we?
Well, Sharapova became a clay court specialist by the end of her career. So maybe it will be a 180 for him and he'll just love the grass of SW19. Or maybe French Open.
Well, it's funny because you speak about his, his mentality, and I think he's got a really cool, calm mentality. I think we saw that on the court. He's not a very vocal player like I think Alcaraz. When he's looking for inspiration, he'll put his arms about and kind of G up the crowd. I think that was sort of what was one of the more kind of compelling factors, kind of watching it on TV last night, was yeah, for me, Ruud was very measured in his approach. And I sort of felt like, you know, based on his experience at Roland Garros, that, you know, that was that's the way that kind of that kind of works for him. And I do think he has I like to think anyway, he has like a champion's mentality. You know, he's got great gamesmanship. He gave a point to Alcaraz, I think, on a double bounce early on in the final yesterday, which was, you know, great to see. He didn't even wait for the replays to come up on the screen. But yeah, I certainly think there are opportunities to work on some of his shots. I still think his backhand side is a little bit weaker than his forehand, and maybe he didn't get as many free points as he was hoping to yesterday. But yeah, he's still got all the tools there that do make you think that, you know, we could be talking about him in the future as a Grand Slam champion.
And as a world number one as well. I mean, it's, he's, what I liked is that they're both nice blokes as well at the end of the day. They're good guys, aren't they? And it was a nice final. And I think it was good for tennis that we had this kind of, like, both players potentially being, you know, like winning to become world number one. And I just think, yeah, this is a great story. And I think Alcaraz is someone who can maybe get a new generation of fans on board as well. They see him, they see how young he is, how exciting he is. And people who may have got a bit bored of the big three and the big four, maybe thinking, oh yeah, it's this guy's turn now, I'm going to follow him. So, yeah.
How did you feel kind of watching it based on the fact that, yeah, this was, you know, a final between two relative novices compared to, you know, no big three involvement, you know, no Rafa, no, obviously Djokovic not there, you know, no Federer. How did it feel kind of watching this? Did it feel like a moment to you in terms of, actually, this is now the moment that we're going to see more and more of these finals between players that, you know, have not been at this stage before? I you know, granted that, you know, this season still three of the four Slam champions have been Rafa or Novak, but how did it make you feel watching this final and it specifically being two relative novels at this, you know, stage in the competition?
I think it's a shame, you know, that we haven't been able to have kind of all of the top sort of players. When we talk about the big three, obviously it's been a while since Federer has played. We haven't had Djokovic at every Slam for obvious reasons. So I think the hype and the way that people perceived the final, it definitely wasn't a bad tennis match. They pulled good numbers. They both had a good winner to unforced errors differential. But for me,
brought out all the celebrities as well.
Oh, it certainly did. But I also think it's something where I do miss having, I would have loved it if he'd got the chance to win it against one of the big ones, you know? And I think that's something that there is always that question around this sort of stuff. But that's why I was actually very pleased that Carlos did win, because he has beaten, obviously in Madrid, he took them both out to win the title. So he has proved himself against them this year. It's such a shame that we didn't necessarily get those, well, that matchup in this tournament, and that kind of the highest ranked player that he did play was the number five. In what was kind of the top four seeds were kind of not necessarily the big three or the big four as we know it, or some of the higher ranked players that we've known over the years. So I'm kind of bittersweet about it. Very pleased that he won and that he was the person that won it. But for me, it lacked the fireworks.
You want him to beat Djokovic or Rafa, basically.
That's essentially what I'm after.
Yeah. I was thinking, oh, how many people were going to say this isn't like as credible a victory because he didn't have to beat a big three. But I don't think we've heard that as much as I
think it definitely is credible. Definitely is credible. I'm not saying that.
I still think we're still having those murmurs, not necessarily about the Slam, but about the number one ranking, because Alcaraz is the world number one, but the number of points he has is relatively few compared to, you know, some of the other active players when they had to reach, you know, number one for the first time. As a comparison, Alcaraz, 6,740 points. When Andy Murray reached number one for the first time, he needed 11,185 points. I mean, again, Kim, to your point, there are going to be people out there who, I'm not saying any of us are one of them, but who knows? Maybe
I'm not.
Maybe you guys aren't. But there are going to be people out there who just will say, yes, he's number one, but that has to have an asterisk next to it because Novak Djokovic, you know, hasn't been able to play the whole season. I mean, where do you guys stand on this debate? I think for me, like, rankings at the moment are just such it's a great headline, and it's amazing that, you know, he's done this, you know, at such a young age, never been done before, youngest world number one. But I still feel, for me at the moment, just rankings are a bit much of a muchness at the moment, because of still we're trying to work out all these situations around, you know, coming out of the, you know, the pandemic, how points are distributed, all this sort of stuff. And so maybe for me, yeah, world number one doesn't mean as much to me at the moment, arguably, than it did, say, pre-pandemic.
I feel like he's number one in the race, if that makes sense. That's what I feel. I feel like he is. He's played a lot of tournaments this year, but I do think if you've won two slams, compared to kind of the rest of the field who have one slam each in terms of Alcaraz and Djokovic obviously not being particularly active, it does put a slightly different lens on it, but I don't think it takes away from the achievement in terms of being able to win a slam.
Say
and
you're
able
the
to...
world number one, yeah.
Yeah, and he's won Masters ahead of this. It's not like it's a result that's come out of nowhere. I mean, people did call it, and Kim obviously did call it. It's not something that's kind of come out of no form. So I don't think it's too much of a question, but I do think the rankings, and that's an ATP issue rather than an Alcaraz issue, you know? Not, you can't take anything away from the fact that he is now the world number one based on the tournaments he's played and the points he's won from them.
Yeah, precisely. And at least we don't have a situation like where, I don't know, Wozniacki or Pliskova were top of the WTA tour and everyone was having a go at them for not having won a slam at the time. So, we'll give Alcaraz his due. Yeah, exactly. We sound like we're being really negative.
No, we love it.
just a note on another final that happened on the Sunday, which was the ladies' doubles final. Another really, remarkable kind of outcome. A really nice Barbora Krejcikova and Katerina Siniaková. They won their first US Open title, which now means that they've done the career golden slam. So they've won all the slams. They've won the Olympics. They've won the world, not the world tour finals, the WTA finals as well. They were a set and 4-1 down to Katie McNally and Taylor Townsend. They fought back to win, dominating that third set 6-1. And just really nice. They're obviously such a cracking team, as we know. And they've the first, I think, women's doubles team to have done the career golden slam now, plus the WTA finals. So yeah, making history.
Are we still talking about Barbora Krejcikova as a
Grand Slam singles champion,
as a leading lady in like singles and doubles, or are we back to Barbora Krejcikova like double specialist? Is that a bit too soon?
A bit too soon. She's coming back from injury. She has won 10 Grand Slams in total. One of them was singles, you know. So I just think she's obviously a very good doubles player. And Joel, you do love to, if someone's too good at doubles, you're like, just play doubles, just stick with the doubles. Like Mertens, you're like, is she just a doubles player?
Yes.
But she can obviously play singles as well, Joel.
Also, there shouldn't be any of this just a doubles player, because is Coco Gauff still doubles world number one? And she could have, you know, she got to the quarters. And has been a, you know, slam singles.
Joe Salisbury, not just a doubles player.
Gauff has taken over from Krejcikova in my book as the leading lady in singles and doubles at the moment.
Okay. I mean, wasn't Ash Barty number one at the same time or in both, or a top 10 in both?
She had some
like
good
that.
Ones. I think Ostapenko is one of my top for both. She's just reached a career high WTA doubles ranking coming off this tournament. I think she might be live ranking number 7. Please correct me if I'm wrong, either of you. I'm not sure you're following that one quite as closely as me. But
she's been playing with Kitchenok or something, hasn't she, of late, I think?
Yeah, they've been putting it together. Yeah. They I think they had going into this tournament, I think like 3 third set tie breaks. So they get it done the hard way. But this was a fantastic achievement from the Czech pair.
But also from Taylor Townsend, Chris, because know that you're quite a fan of Taylor Townsend, and obviously she got to the final at her home slam, unseeded, but they almost did it. They could have won. But Taylor Townsend, she's got quite a interesting backstory, hasn't she? I think, was it 10 years ago, she was rejected by the USTA, essentially, wasn't given her funding anymore.
Yeah, it was a really shocking story, and she wrote a piece recently in the Players Tribune about this. And what happened was she was the world number one in singles as a junior. And at the time, she was given a call which said that she had to go on an 8-week training camp because they thought she wasn't fit enough. And that would mean missing the US Open. And so essentially, they were taking that opportunity away from her. And they said that if she didn't go on the fitness camp, then she wouldn't get the funding to go. So she actually self-funded her trip to New York that year as the world number one in juniors. And she won the junior doubles titles and reached the quarterfinals in the singles. And when she was asked in a press conference why she hadn't had a wild card as the junior number one to the main draw, she thought, you know what, I'm just going to tell them everything that's happened. And she did. And after that, she did get her funding. Didn't get her funding taken away, but it then meant that they did pay for her travel there. And it was a very big story, but it definitely created a big rift between her and the USTA. And so it's fantastic after everything she's been through to be able to play this tennis again. She's a mother now. She reached a semi-final at the French Open with Madison Keys. And it's just a shame she couldn't get those last two games after putting together such a fantastic final up to that point.
It would have been a real up yours moment, wouldn't it, if she had won the title? Because from reading about it, Patrick McEnroe of the USTA was sort of part of that controversy you're talking about relating to her fitness when she was a very, very good junior, and he was there at the presentation for the doubles trophy yesterday. Just reading about that for me was a little bit beggar's belief. I couldn't believe that they would court controversy or just maybe incite it a little bit by having him present.
It wasn't a good look. And I think there's a lot of things that have happened in Taylor Townsend's career where a lot of people have said a lot of things. And I'm sure when you look back at someone like Serena's career as well, a lot of people would have said, who were very influential, said things that definitely now are not acceptable. So I think it's the nature of the institution is that she was always kind of against the norm, and she was made to feel like that. So getting to a Grand Slam final and playing as well as she did, I think it's so impressive that she said that everything that she's done at this point is on her. It's not because of opportunity she's had. She's done it, and I think she can be very proud irrespective of that, and the future looks bright for her, especially when it comes to doubles.
Yeah, exactly. So really nice that she's sort of had a good fortnight at the US Open after all of the stuff that she's been through. So good positive outcome, I think, all round for the participants of the ladies doubles final. And we'll be catching up on more finals action after a short break. So do not go anywhere. We'll also be revealing our collector set winner, which is very, very exciting. Welcome back to our US Open Finals catch-up, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com. And let's move on to the ladies' singles final now, which took place on Saturday evening. We've already alluded to the winner, of course. Iga Świątek has won her third Grand Slam title, her first on a hard court. And she did that by beating Ons Jabeur in straight sets, 6-2, 7-6. So another disappointment for Ons Jabeur, second straight Grand Slam final loss in a row. But Iga Świątek proving once again that she is an absolute demon when it comes to finals. I think she's only ever lost one final in her whole career, which was the first final she ever played, age 17 or something. Since then, she's won every final, I think, in straight sets. I mean, going into a final, having that record, you must think that you're kind of untouchable almost, mustn't you? It's crazy.
I'm not gonna lie, I was still skeptical, and me and Chris on our semi-finals pod, we definitely differed on what sort of Świątek we were going to get in the final, because I felt, based on the performances we've seen this tournament, that Jabeur really had a good chance of winning. But I didn't factor in that Świątek was gonna just elevate her level to a level, quite frankly, in that first set, I don't think we had seen, since the clay season, really. And that really did take me by surprise. I think it took Jabeur a little bit by surprise as well, because it was such a quick start. And that first set was over in a flash. 6-2, 30 minutes. Świątek, 90% first serves in. her return game was exceptional. She got 100% returns in play, 19 of 19, 3 of 4 break points won. It really did catch me, and I think a lot of people by surprise. But Chris, you weren't surprised because you said on the semi-finals catch up that you think she needs to play her best game of the tournament, and she went and did that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna. You said it, not me, Joel. I haven't brought it up. I was just gonna very humbly just talk about how the match went and not draw attention to the fact that I got this prediction right. But no, I think as I said, like if she played her best and if she turned up like she's turned up in finals, she'd be very, very tricky to beat. And Ons did do a good job considering that Iga was playing so well in the first set to make it close, and Ons was obviously struggling to play her best game, and it could have almost gone to 3.
I think I messaged you and said, like, after the first 15 minutes, I was like, this is giving me Pliskova Wimbledon vibes.
You got nervous early. Yeah, you abandoned your Ons prediction after the first change of ends.
Yeah, I was like, oh, what have I done?
Yeah, exactly. But I think as we say, if you get to the final, and Carlos said sort of a similar thing, he said that when you're in a final, everything changes. He forgot he was tired. That he had all those hours of running in his legs, and it's almost like Iga just wiped the slate clean of the sort of the hiccups against Yul Niemeyer, like when we were on Kim, last week, and we were worried about how that result was going to go. We thought it was looking unlikely, and then she stormed back to take it 6-love in a flourish. So I think it's it doesn't matter how you get to the final. Once you're there, it's what game you bring on the day.
Bit like Alcaraz, he had to kind of scrap through a few 5-set matches.
Wasn't always pretty.
Świątek, as you've said, has not played her best tennis this fortnight. She'd be the first to admit that, but she did what she needed to do. And then once she got to the final form of Świątek that we know kind of came to the fore, and Jabeur was not at the races, hence the outcome that we got.
I will say, though, what still for me wasn't pretty in the final was that match point. I she went and got her a new racket whilst Jabeur was serving. I know after the match Jabeur said that she wasn't even aware that Świątek did that because it happened so quickly, she was so focused. But I certainly think in terms of how that looked to the crowd and how that looked to me on TV, I didn't think that was particularly sportsmanlike. And again, there's been call outs specifically of Świątek's net play. There's been a few instances, again, I saw in the final where she does this thing. She likes to wave her racket, doesn't she, when the ball is still in play with the opponent. And again, I think Mark Petchy on commentary at the time was said, is that hindrance? Is she actively putting off the player? And, I think there are people out there who will say, this is, Świątek's such a unique and quirky character, and this is one of her personality traits on the tennis court. But for me, there are a couple of instances where I'm a bit like, I would have a if I was in her coaching team, I would be saying, have a think about how that projects, I feel, onto the TV, because you're such a great personality, you've got such a great game, but some of these things I feel don't necessarily adhere you to all the tennis fans.
Goodness, Joel, I feel like you're really coming for Iga there. That was a double whammy, I think, when it came to...
In the most polite
agree,
way possible.
Yes, I do agree that it was very odd to decide to change your string tension and swap your racket when match point down, and it wasn't on her serve. So that's the bit that I didn't necessarily like, is that she made Ons wait to serve. And obviously, you're supposed to... She hadn't broken a string, and you're supposed to play to the speed of your opponent. So that is a bad look, I would say that.
You just know if that is someone like a Yastrzemska or an Ostapenko, if Świątek
I'd be furious.
If Świątek is running to sort her racket out, I'd just put my serve in and be like, hey, you're gonna play to my speed. You can go away and change your racket. But
God, that would make tennis Twitter, Joel, if you did that. That would definitely make tennis Twitter. But I think when it comes to the thing at the net where she sort of like spreads both arms and kind of dances around at the net to try and distract the opponent.
It's like a snow angel sort of motion.
Yeah,
it
is unusual.
Like upright snow angel.
Maybe we need Kim to decide this on the hindrance. I think that based on what we've read in the rules, it would be hard to prove it was hindrance because that could be what would give her the best chance of getting the ball back by having the maximum sort of wingspan. I'm not sure what you could say, like different people have different ready positions. Mm. Navratilova said it wasn't hindrance, but I kind of feel like it would impede on your opponent.
If that's in my eye line and I put the ball into the net, I think I've got a good argument to make to the umpire to be like, you know, she's trying to put me off by, you know, making a silly face, but like making like a silly body movement. I don't know.
Define silly. I think it's quite hard, isn't it?
I agree. It didn't feel natural.
It didn't feel natural.
It felt comic.
She was like raising her racket. It wasn't like coming down or getting into the ready position. It didn't feel like, anyway.
She doesn't strike me as the sort of person that would resort to kind of petty...
It wasn't gamesmanship. No. I think she just thought it would give her the best chance, but it just came across badly, potentially. But still, it was a great performance from her. But what do you think for Ons? Were you slightly disappointed? I know that, Joel, you had high hopes.
Yeah. I do you know what? I was actually impressed by how she bounced back from that first set and was able to take it to a tiebreak because... as Kim, you alluded to, Świątek's record in finals has been unbelievable. And I don't think she's not even come close to facing, you know, going the full distance in a set to a tiebreak before, you know, the ladies final in New York. So that for me was impressive. Again, I do wonder, and I think, you know, she spoke about it in the match, in the press conference afterwards, that I think there was still a bit of scar tissue there from the Wimbledon final, and it stopped her from starting, I think, you know, on the right foot. And I think, again, it really kind of calls into question, I think, her approach and how she starts a Grand Slam final. And felt to me like she was very much in her shell and, you know, not playing necessarily to her strengths. I think she could have gone to the crowd a bit more. I think she could have involved them a bit more. You know, it didn't feel like she was confident in all of her shot making capabilities. We didn't really see a lot of the, you know, the backhand slice. The drop shot wasn't functioning as well as we've seen it in the past. So for me, I think there's still, you know, if I look at Ruud and Jabeur and think, yeah, there are definite parallels there in terms of what they've accomplished this season. I still actually think, you know, Ruud maybe is a little bit closer to winning a Grand Slam versus Ons Jabeur based on what we've seen so far, and also the fact that Iga Świątek just feels like she's streets ahead of everyone else at the moment.
There definitely wasn't the clarity of thought for some of Jabeur's shot making. I mean, she almost did a couple of, I mean, some of the worst drop shots I've ever seen her hit at times, which were not opportune. So I think that there's something in it where she obviously isn't able to play necessarily her best game or the game played to her strength. As you say, like, she was hitting the ball a lot more than she was slicing. She wasn't giving Iga as many different looks on the ball as she's given her opponents and made it really difficult, such as when she played Garcia. So I think it is a shame, but I don't know. What do you think, Kim? Do you think this is a bit of a disappointing performance, or can she take a lot from it?
I think she will be disappointed that it wasn't closer, and I know obviously she did break back in that second set and take it to the tie break, but I think obviously it could very well have been a bit of a more comfortable win for Świątek, which I think she'd be disappointed at, because I mean really she did better in the Wimbledon final, you know, getting it that first set, and so you could kind of say, oh, this is a bit of a regression. However, it is the world number one that you're up against, who has a ridiculous level in finals, but I think, you know, she's certainly that both of these players have the most match wins from the last two seasons on the tour. She's, you know, definitely improved so much from where she was. She's obviously got a really good attitude. She's always developing. So I certainly think she's a player that at her time, I do think she'll win a Grand Slam one day. And I don't know. I kind of disagree. I think she's more likely to than Casper Ruud. So
I also agree with that. I think I can see her getting one. Sorry, Joel, we're ganging up on you in this one.
Okay.
She's got the magic. The Ons magic.
Do you not think Iga Świątek is, you know, there's already talk about the fact that, you know, she's won two Grand Slams this season. Going into next season, do you see that continuing? Do you see, I mean, dare I say, talk of a career calendar slam? Ward completing the set? Do you think that is on the cards based on the level we have seen? I'm struggling to think of who is formidable enough that is going to come up against Iga Świątek and defeat her. And all I'm coming back with is only if Ash Barty comes out of retirement at the moment.
Really? I was thinking, what if she's in a final again against Polona Hercog? Like, you know, back in the day when she lost that first final.
Very true.
Her nemesis. But I think a lot of the pundits have said, and Mats Wilander said, that she is just head and shoulders above the rest, he believes, in terms of she moves better than anyone else on the tour. And some of her movement, especially to her backhand side, does make me gasp. Like how she managed to get herself into position to put so much work on the ball whilst being almost off balance. So there are aspects of her game that are unbelievable, and her shot making is good. We talked about the serve. If the serve isn't on song, you'll get some opportunities. But I mean, as you say, like I wouldn't be surprised.
Her return game again is so
it is good. So yeah, good that
even when she does, like for example, in the final, whenever she did get broken, we saw some great responses in terms of breaking straight back. And again, you can never, I feel like, rest easy with, you know, Świątek across the net for you. Even if you've just broken her, it's not a done deal until you can, you know, you serve out your game. And I think that's been one of the impressive things about her over the last 2 weeks, is that when her service games haven't, you know, gone to plan, and there have been, you know, occasions through the tournament when that's happened, her return game has really come in to focus there. And, you know, she's been able to break her opponents. At times it felt like, you know, at will, just to keep her, you know, to keep her in the sets.
Yeah, Iga and Carlos, they both have that champions mindset that we've seen in so many of the great players over the years. Some of the stats are that she's kind of the first player to win three majors at the age that she is since Sharapova, and all the different comparisons you can have in terms of the fact that she's won her third major before turning 22, and that's the likes of like Justin Ennen, Serena Williams, Venus Williams, Monica Seles, Steffi Graf, Chris Evert, like the company she keeps. I mean, those are all absolute legends of the game. So who's to say? I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if you picked up another couple of Grand Slams next year, but I can't see that happening across all four. Oh, I mean, it's just... Kim,
I think that's a bit...
help me out.
I know. I've just been listening to you two debate. I don't...
Ringleader.
No, I'm not seeing it.
Kim, I feel like you're just
collecting
nodding in disapproval in silence, being
saying?
Like, what is Joel saying here?
What are you going on about? Yeah, I know.
No, I mean,
I'm very conscious about like not getting carried away because I don't think she needs to do the calendar slam to like prove anything. I think over the course of her career, I have confidence that she would, you know, win all four slams.
That's a Wimbledon, better answer, Kim.
Wimbledon being the one that she'd need to work a bit more on, obviously, as most people. But yeah, I think obviously she's so young as well, isn't she? It's crazy how much she's been able to achieve at such a young age as well.
I mean, are you worried that, you know, Ons Jabeur, we've been saying, is the de facto like world number two in the women's game at the moment, and Świątek defeated her in straight sets, and, you know, a common talking point of the tour this year has been about who are the rivalries that are going to excite people and interest people and bring people into tennis. Is there a nervousness or a worry that, you know, we're nowhere nearer any sort of rivalry, because the dominance of Świątek is just so much at the moment that is it detrimental to the advertisement of women's tennis when, you know, we're thinking, oh, Iga Świątek's, you know, winning again, versus, you know, oh, really compelling rivalries. And actually, if Ons Jabeur had won, you know, in the US Open final, it would have been like, ooh, you know, that could lead to something a bit more, with a bit more edge and a bit more spice to it.
They're both bringing great things to the game. I think Ons and Iga are two players that are definitely doing the WTA proud in terms of they're putting together those amazing results. They're putting together the results that are consistent across the season, especially at the slams and the big tournaments. I think I have a disappointment with the WTA at the moment that there's, as you say, Joel, I'm going to put you on blast again with the part-time player. There are a lot of players that don't always play and don't always play kind of at their best, and or for various reasons, they're not able to play in all the tournaments that are happening.
we just do not get many top 10 versus top 10 matchups at Grand Slam.
Yeah, did you see the stat that was... This was the first slam this year where there were top 10 matchups in the first quarterfinal of a Grand Slam that was between two seeded players to reach that stage. And that just shows that it's the top players, like, for example, I mean, Annette Kontaveit, who's obviously a good player. She might be a top 10 player. She's not a world number two. And I feel like the fact that she can reach that stage without really putting together any wins in Grand Slams, I think it does show that the WTA is kind of in a bit of a...
It can produce great matches, but
there's free for all.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel like there's rivalries that, you know, can do that. And maybe Iga Świątek is a symptom of that based on just how good she is.
Well, you can't blame her for being too good. I mean, it's not her fault.
No, but... I kind of will, Kim.
But I think the others...
Joel is good. He's good at blame her for it.
Yeah, I don't know where this angst has come from. Maybe I'm just really annoyed about how she conducts herself at the net.
I think it was the racket change. That was it.
But I mean, the fact that she's so good, and even like when she's not playing her best, can win a Grand Slam. That is like she's a new target now, and that should hopefully compel everyone to try and reach her level. And you know,
and
a bit
compel
like
Ash Barty to come out of retirement.
Well, you never know, do you? that was a very premature retirement, in my opinion. So there's whole host of things there, but. Yeah, I mean, what do you think, like looking back at all of maybe the women's slam finals then from this year, do you think that we've had, obviously, I mean, this final we had Świątek Szabor, that was more competitive than the French Open final with Coco Gauff. But where do you, for me, I think the Wimbledon final was probably the standout one amongst them all, but I don't think we've had any sort of real classics. I think that would be going a stretch to say that they've been that. And I see what you're saying, Joel, but I think that Świątek, having carved out this kind of status now for herself, I think hopefully that's going to drive everyone up to meet her.
I just want to see great tennis players playing their best tennis in finals. And I think we haven't necessarily had that in many of the Grand Slams. I think Rybakina played some of the best tennis I've seen all year in that Wimbledon final. She was playing unbelievably, but at that time, Ons was going off the boil. And in the same way, kind of in the Iga Coco Gauff final at the French Open, that one didn't really get going. And it had sort of a similar feel to this one, where that second set in the US Open final we've just had, that was probably it was the tightest set we've had. But I would say Australia... That for me, with the added dynamic of Ash being Australian and that second set where Danielle Collins was really playing some great tennis, I think that was probably the most engaged I've been in the final this year.
Yeah, I'm with you. I really enjoyed that Barty Collins final. So I'm going to put that up there. I mean, my final question to you both is, do you prefer how I think we're getting to two very different places for the ATP Tour versus the WTA Tour? Because on the WTA Tour, Kim, as you said, we're getting to this point now where it's like Świątek is so streets ahead of everyone else. I think she's got more ranking points than the rest of the top 10 combined. So she's got a target on her back. And that is compelling in the sense of you're wondering, oh, who's the next challenger? Could they defeat Świątek? Versus the ATP Tour, where it feels a lot more bunched together, you know. For example, in the final, Casper Ruud could have jumped from ranking number 7 to ranking number 1. And as a result there, it feels like we've got that opportunity to have those rivalries. You know, Alcaraz Sinner, for example, great matchup in the quarterfinals. What is more compelling to you? Is it that sort of challenger approach that we've got we've got evolving on the WTA Tour, or on the ATP Tour, where it's like we've got a bunch of players, there's not really one standout at the moment? Yes, you know, we've got a couple of aging, greats, but we've got more opportunity to develop, you know, match rivalries.
Yeah, I think it's the rivalry aspect, isn't it? I'm looking forward to more Alcaraz Sinner, for example, whereas on the WTA Tour, I'm not seeing
Sloane anybody. That's what I'm looking forward to.
I'm still looking forward to Caroline Garcia completing the renaissance. So
progress.
You know, who knows if it'd been her against Iga in the final. I'm pretty sure it would still have gone the same way with Iga winning, but there we go. Let's touch base on all the other finals we've had, because there have been others. I know you touched upon Joe Salisbury the other day, which is just brilliant for Joe. But we had the mixed doubles as well. John Peers and Storm Sanders winning for Australia over Kirsten Flipkins and Edouard Rojavasselin. I didn't know Rojavasselin was still playing, actually. I kind of thought he might have retired by now. And I thought Flipkins had retired, but obviously she has decided to do a bit of mixed doubles. Why not? But yeah, Peers and Sanders won in a match tiebreak. So that was their first title. I think it's their first time playing together.
Yeah, it's their first tournament.
At a slam. So yeah, way to go. And yeah, brilliant stuff.
You must be thrilled, Joel, by the way, because Joel was the number one Storm Sanders supporter at the Billie Jean King Cup. Oh, he had his Australia shirt on.
And oh, yes.
Do you remember? I snuck in to go like three rows to the front.
Almost the player box, yeah.
Yeah. And I left you
and Alatomjanovic
in the top tier. I left you.
Yeah,
in the top
I was
tier,
like, where's he gone? And then I saw him
just
down there.
At
yeah.
You. Yes.
Yeah. I did join him eventually, in fairness.
Were
you
not there for Sam Stosur? Have you moved on to Storm Sanders instead, Joel?
I didn't think Sam Stosur was there, was she?
Oh.
Alicia Mollick was there. She was heading up the team as the coach. But Storm, what a year she had coming into the doubles. She had the semi-finals in the women's doubles as well. But I mean, I think Sam Stosur was there cheering them on. So maybe she was the good luck charm they needed.
She's passed the baton on to another Australian.
I think she's going to keep playing until her early 50s at this rate.
And then in the juniors, we had two individuals from the Rafa Nadal Academy. We had Alexandra Ayala from the Philippines winning over Lucy Lavichkova. I think that might be right. I wanted to say Lavichkova, who is obviously not a junior player, but an existing player. But yeah, first Filipino to win a Grand Slam junior singles title. And then on the men's, we had a Spanish player, Martin Landaluce, winning the boys singles.
Was he older than Carlos?
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, to be fair,
he could be 18.
He could be around the same age. Yeah. But great for Spain as well, because they also, in the wheelchair doubles, there was a Spanish guy who won the wheelchair men's doubles, De La Puente and Pfeiffer. They beat Alfie Hewitt and Gordon Reid. So they didn't quite manage to get another slam, but they've got plenty, so we can't be too disheartened. Alfie Hewitt did, however, win the singles in the wheelchair event over Shingo Kuneda. And Joel, you'll be pleased that Deirdre De Groot won both the singles and the doubles with Van Coot. So obviously keeping that all going. But yeah, just a couple of the wheelchair results. They also did junior wheelchairs for the first time, which is fantastic.
Amazing.
So yeah, good stuff. But we do, we're running out of time, I have to say. So we do need to announce our collector set winner now.
Is it Joel?
You were in the running, weren't you, Joel?
I was in the running.
And we had to do a tiebreak question. And the tiebreak question that we asked the five individuals who were in the running was, how many games would the loser of Alcaraz versus Casper Ruud score? We had various...
It was quite split.
Guesses.
It was quite split, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think three people went for, something quite close to what actually happened. So they thought it was going to be a bit tighter. And we had two that went for a much lower score. So they obviously thought it was going to be a bit of a drubbing. But yeah, we do have a winner, and that is Becky Moran. So well done, Becky. You were the closest to guess the number of games that the runner-up would win. And also, Becky was the only person to predict that Alcaraz would win. So that's another
flex.
Added bonus. And she also, got Caroline Garcia correct as well. So Becky, well done.
Tennis Weekly Mud coming your way.
Yeah, we've been in contact, so we'll be sending out your lovely prize soon. So thank you and well done. And thanks to everyone for taking part again in Collector Set. We hope you enjoyed taking part.
Yes, thanks everyone for taking part in Collector Set and also being with us for the last couple of weeks for our US Open round by round coverage. Hope you've really enjoyed listening to our thoughts at Tennis Weekly. It's been a bit of a team effort this time round with us and also Chris getting on board. So
Chris, just from myself and Kim, thank you so much for coming on and bringing all your thoughts onto the show.
So many thoughts.
I'm just surprised you didn't bring out Rebecca Marino in our final one, because she won today. She's in Chennai.
She's seeded. Yes, indeed. A good first round win.
She was the player that I said would definitely not be winning the US Open. In
another prediction you got right, Kim.
I know. Oh,
that and Carlos.
I'm an absolute genius. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, just if we needed to know a fact that I feel like we already know that tennis never stops. So there you go. We already have Chennai in the WTA tour going on, which is a 250 event. We also have Portoroz as well. Emma Raducanu. Guys, you're going to love this. Diana Rastremska retired 2 points from defeat against Emma Raducanu.
No.
Up to classic Rastremska tactics, but Raducanu top seed is through in front of a crowd of about four people. So it's all back onto the tour. And listeners, I hope you've enjoyed listening to our US Open coverage. We will be back. We will be going back into tour catch-up mode. We're going to have a little bit of a holiday. We won't be with you next Monday, but we will be with you shortly after. So we're going to be going on our own holidays, having a little of a breather. But make sure to subscribe to us to stay up to date on the rest of the tour action this season. On whatever device you listen to us on, we're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. You can also listen to us on the DownloadTennis.com app. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And you can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Tennis Weekly Pod. So do give us a like and a follow if you do not already. And you can also let us know all your feedback, comments, and any questions you may have for the Tennis Weekly mailbag. And if you prefer, you can email us at tennisweeklypod@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out our website, www.tennisweekly.co.uk.
And we will be back next time at Tennis Weekly HQ, back in tour catch-up mode in a couple of weeks. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Kim.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Chris.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you again soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.